Hey everyone, welcome back. Are you ready for another deep dive?
Always ready to dig into the past.
Great. Today we're going back to ancient Israel.
Fascinating period.
It is. Specifically, we're looking at the Book of Judges.
Often overlooked, but so crucial.
Right. Full of drama, intrigue, even maybe a daring escape or two.
Oh, some wild stories in there for sure.
But we're going beyond the surface. We've got excerpts from an expert biblical archaeologist, Dr. Jeffrey Huden.
Excellent resource.
So buckle up. We're going to separate fact from fiction and see what archaeology really tells us about this era.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, so the Judges period sometimes gets lost, you know, between the Exodus and the Kings.
Right. It's that bridge between them, the Israelites entering Canaan and then eventually establishing a kingdom. Lots of, well, growing pains is maybe a good way to put it.
Definitely some ups and downs.
Okay.
But before we get to the drama, where does archaeology even start with this time period?
Well, one of the most important pieces of evidence is the Merneptah stele. It's this big inscribed stone monument set up by an Egyptian pharaoh around 1205 BC. And get this, it mentions Israel, like specifically as a people already in Canaan.
Whoa, so we have actual proof outside the Bible that they were there at that time.
Exactly. And it's super early. One of the earliest mentions of Israel we have anywhere. That's why it's such a big deal.
That's pretty awesome. So, okay, we know they were there. But how do archaeologists actually tell what's Israelite stuff, you know, from everything else? It's all like old pottery and broken walls, right?
It's a bit more complicated than that. Pottery, for example, can be helpful. Israelites had some distinct styles.
Okay.
Like the collar rim jar. It's a big storage jar with this rim that really does look like a collar.
Uh-huh. Literally a collar. Easy to picture.
Right. But even though these pottery styles can be helpful, they weren't only used by Israelites. Other groups in the area used similar stuff.
You can't just jump to conclusions based on pottery alone.
You got it. It's got to be about the bigger picture, putting together lots of clues.
Like a detective. So what other clues are there to Israelite culture?
Well, their houses are really interesting. A particular type of house became common during this time, the four-room house.
I've heard of those. What's so special about them? Like ancient apartments or something?
Not quite apartments, but they were really well designed. Picture a rectangular building divided into four rooms, typically livestock on the ground floor, and the family lived upstairs.
To avoid the smell, I'm guessing.
Probably. And here's the cool part. The back room of the house, it could actually be part of the village wall.
Whoa, a house that's also a fortress. That's amazing.
Right. So this unique design, it wasn't just practical. It really shows Israelite identity and how their culture developed.
So we're starting to get a picture of their daily life.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Huden also mentions this city, Debir. What's the story there?
Debir pops up in the story of Othniel. He's traditionally seen as the first judge. He conquers the city as part of a challenge to win Caleb's daughter.
Wow, high stakes. So, do we know where Debir actually was?
That's where it gets really interesting. Two big names in biblical archaeology, William Albright and Moshe Kochavi, both said they'd found Debir, but at different locations.
Wait, two famous archaeologists disagreeing? It's like a real-life archaeology mystery?
Exactly. Albright, he was huge in the field, thought Debir was at a site called Tel Beit Mirsim.
Okay.
By the way, that means it's a mound made of layers of human occupation over centuries.
Ah, so not just any hill, a hill made by history.
Exactly. Anyway, Kochavi later excavated a place called Kerbet Rabud. He argued, pretty convincingly, that that was the real Debir.
So how did he prove Albright wrong?
Kochavi found stuff that matched the biblical description of Debir. Like, it had two springs.
Yeah.
It was a good reminder that even the biggest names can be wrong. New evidence can always change things.
Good lesson for all of us.
Yeah.
Okay, I got to ask about one of the, shall we say, more memorable stories from Judges. The story of Ehud.
Oh, yes.
Assassination, a rather large king, and a very unique escape route.
That's one way to put it. This is where things get really interesting.
I'm all ears. Let's hear about this escape.
So Ehud, he's this left-handed Israeli judge,
yeah.
Right? And he's sent to deliver tribute to Eglon, the Moabite king, who's, you know, oppressing Israel at the time. Ehud, he's crafty, makes a double-edged sword, hides it under his clothes.
Okay, secret weapon, sneaky plan. What happens next?
He gets a private audience with Eglon, tells him he has a secret message just for him. And then, well, the biblical text uses this Hebrew term that scholars say pretty strongly points to Ehud escaping through Eglon's, shall we say, private chamber.
He escapes through the toilet. I know we talked about this earlier, but it's got to be one of the most creative escape routes ever.
It definitely sticks in your mind, that's for sure. It's caused a lot of discussion. But, you know, beyond the unconventional exit strategy, the story is really about this idea of using smarts and, well, unusual tactics in warfare. Remember, the Israelites are often outnumbered, outgunned by their enemies.
So they got to be clever, use surprise to get an advantage, like a David and Goliath story. But instead of a slingshot, it's a hidden sword and a well-timed escape through, well, you know.
Exactly. It shows how resourceful they were, how they adapted to being oppressed.
Okay, so we've talked about the Moabites, but one of the biggest threats to the Israelites during this whole period was the Philistines, right? I'm thinking big battles, strong men, maybe a collapsing temple or two.
You're getting the picture. The Philistines were a serious force. Part of this larger group called the Sea Peoples, who moved all across the Mediterranean, really shook things up, even for the Egyptians. There are actually carvings on the walls of Ramses III's mortuary temple showing their battles.
No way. They fought the Egyptians.
Oh, yeah. And they actually weakened Egypt quite a bit, which is part of how they became so powerful in the region. They settled along the coast of Canaan, right in the middle of where the Israelites were trying to establish themselves. They brought new technologies like ironworking and really changed the whole scene politically and culturally.
So it wasn't just fighting, it was this whole clash of cultures.
Absolutely. And that's the context for the famous story of Samson, the Israelite strongman who, as you said, brings down a Philistine temple.
That's the story I was waiting for. But is there, like, actual archaeological evidence for any of this?
Well, we can't say for sure if Samson existed or if the temple fell exactly like the story says. But excavations at a place called Tel Kazil, they found a Philistine temple with two central pillars holding up the roof, just like the one Samson destroys in the Bible.
Hmm. So, maybe not proof, but it shows the writers knew about Philistine architecture, makes the story feel more, well, real.
Right. It reinforces the idea that these stories, even the more out there ones, they come from a real place, a real time.
It's amazing how archaeology does that, brings these ancient stories to life, gives us a whole new perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of perspective, how accurate is the Book of Judges itself, historically speaking? Can we take it, like, literally?
That's a question scholars have been wrestling with forever. It's interesting, though, the book itself seems to acknowledge things aren't so simple. Judges 1, for example, it talks about the Israelites first conquering Canaan, but it reads more like, I don't know, a military report than a straightforward story.
So more of a summary of what happened, not a play-by-play.
Exactly. And some scholars have pointed out that the language used is similar to Assyrian records from that time. Maybe the writers knew about those records, even borrowed from them a bit.
Wow, so they weren't just making stuff up in isolation. They were drawing on, like, established ways of writing history. But what about that whole cycle of sin, oppression, and deliverance? Is that like a theological thing, or is there any historical truth to it?
Good question. The cyclical pattern, for sure, that's a theological framework, emphasizes the consequences of breaking God's covenant, all that. But the book also says straight up that the Israelites didn't fully conquer Canaan. Certain areas, like the coasts and valleys where the Canaanites were strong, those stayed unconquered.
So it's not just a simple victory story. It's more complex, more realistic about the challenges they faced.
Exactly. Some even call Judges 1 an anti-conquest account. It actually highlights their failures, how they didn't achieve total victory at first.
It's surprising to see that kind of honesty in an ancient text, admitting weaknesses and all that.
That's what makes Judges so interesting. It's a balanced view, shows both the good and the bad, the struggles and the resilience, and in the end, it's about faith, even when things are tough.
Yeah, it really seems like the Book of Judges, it's not just some, you know, dry history book. It's more like this mix of stories and myths and reflections on history all woven together to kind of explore these deeper ideas about identity and faith, what it means to be human.
That's a great way to put it. And that's why it still resonates with people today, I think, that these stories, even the ones with, well, unusual escapes, they get at something universal, you know, about power and struggle, the challenges of building a society, any society.
For sure. We've covered a lot in this deep dive, the archaeology, the historical context, even like the way the book itself is written.
Yeah.
But what really sticks with me is this idea of archaeology being like a window into the past, you know?
Yeah, it's not just about digging stuff up. It's about connecting with the people who were here before us, understanding their lives, what they went through, what they achieved.
And sometimes just being amazed by how clever they were, like those four-room houses turning into fortresses. Or those military strategies they use to overcome what seemed like impossible odds.
It makes you realize, even back then, people were incredibly creative, resilient, figuring things out.
Makes you wonder what else is still out there, buried, waiting to be found, to change how we understand the past.
That's what's so exciting about archaeology. It's this constant process of discovery, always something new to learn.
So for anyone listening who's, you know, feeling inspired to dig a little deeper themselves, what would you recommend? Where should they start?
There are some fantastic museums out there, amazing collections from this period. You can check out online resources, too, or pick up a book on biblical archaeology. And of course, if you ever get the chance to actually visit Israel, see these places firsthand, that's really something special. It really brings it all to life.
Well, this deep dive has been a fascinating glimpse into the world of the Judges. But it's just the beginning, right? There's so much more to explore when it comes to ancient history.
Absolutely. So keep asking questions, keep exploring. Who knows, maybe you'll be the one to make the next big discovery.
That's all the time we have for today's deep dive. We hope this has sparked your curiosity and, well, maybe inspired you to learn a little more. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, keep exploring the past. It's full of surprises.